Tell me, George, why did you become a printer?
Well, I just seemed the right type, you know. A young man was madly in love with a chorus girl, and as her birthday drew near, asked what she would like as a present. She didn't know. How about a book, he suggested. She said, oh, no, thank. No, no, I've got one.
Morning, Arthur. How are the kids?
All fine, Fred.
How many is it now?
Four.
Can I have any more?
No, 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 no. My wife says no more, no.
What's that?
Well, she's read this book, you see. It says every fifth child born in the world is Chinese. Oh. How's this patient getting on, the doctor asked the new nurse. Have you all kept a chart of his progress? Not exactly, doctor, she blushed, but I can show you my diary.
Do you like Kipling?
I don't know. I've never kibbled.
Are you familiar with Dickens?
Yes. I had tea with him yesterday.
Oh, no, that's ridiculous. No, Dickens has been dead for over 100 years.
I thought he was quiet.
An Irishman saw an advertisement in a newspaper for a book on bodybuilding and sent off for it. 3 months later, he wrote back to the publishers. Dear sir, I've now read your book. Please send on the muscles by return. The MO was inspecting a barrack room and found that one private had a locker full of dirty books. Tell me, he said, are you troubled by sexual fantasies?
Oh, no, said the soldier, no. I quite enjoy them, thank you very much.
Much married film star at her 12th wedding to short-sighted old minister trying to find the marriage ceremony in the prayer book. Page 37, darling. Take it from the top.
Most people come up against books at some time in their life. Compulsory education has made it almost unavoidable. Some people worship them, some hate them. The Reverend Sidney Smith liked to be surrounded by them.
No furniture is so charming as books, even if you never open them or read a single word.
Others prefer to limit their reading. A character from Nancy Mitford's The Pursuit of Love.
I've only read one book in my life, and that is White Fang. It's so frightfully good, I've never bothered to read another.
There are extremists who would burn all books on the ground that no good can come of them. Ambrose Bierce claimed to be rather distrustful of writing in one of his definitions.
Ink, a villainous compound of torn a gallet of iron, gum arabic and water, chiefly used to facilitate the infection of idiocy and promote intellectual crime.
The books are also held to be the key to education, and since education is the key to civilization, they must be available all over the world. A report from the Times Educational Supplement.
Obsolete textbooks are being collected by the Education Committee from the authority schools and sent to the English-speaking Union for distribution to Commonwealth countries where they are urgently needed.
There's British magnanimity for you. Say we don't do anything for the Commonwealth. But even in these days of television and other instant media, people still do buy books. There's nothing like a good read. And publishers spend a considerable amount of money advertising books. And some of their recommendations are a bit bizarre. Here's an advertisement taken from the medical press.
Failure of the Heart and Circulation by Terence East, MA, DM, FRCP. This delightful little volume is devoted to problems of central and peripheral circulatory failure. It's far too good to miss.
It's not in a dust jacket, it comes in a straight jacket. Here's a famous item from an antiquarian bookseller's list.
Shelley, Prometheus Unbound, 4 and 9p. Bound, 7 and 6p.
This notice was seen some years ago in the window of an enterprising London bookshop.
Holy Scripture, writ divine, leather bound at 1 and 9. Satan trembles when he sees Bibles sold as cheap as these.
Bookshops are always fascinating, full of exciting new books and people reading them for nothing. A good bookshop has something for every taste.
Good morning. Can you help me? Do you have a copy of 30 Days in the Samarkand Desert with a Spoon by A.E.J. Elliott?
Well, we haven't got it in stock, sir.
How about 101 Ways to Start a Monsoon?
By?
An Indian gentleman whose name eludes me for the moment.
Well, I don't know the book, sir.
Not to worry, not to worry. Can you help me with David Copperfield?
Ah, yes. Dickens.
No. No, Edmund Wells.
I think you'll find Charles Dickens wrote David Copperfield.
No, Charles Dickens wrote David Copperfield with two P's. This is David Copperfield with one P by Edmund Wells.
Well, in that case, we don't have it.
Funny, you've got a lot of books here.
Yes, we do have quite a lot of books here. We don't have David Copperfield with one P by Edmund Wells. We only have David Copperfield with two P's by Charles Dickens.
Pity, it's more thorough than the Dickens.
More thorough?
Yes, I wonder if it's worth having a look through David Copperfield.
I'm quite sure that all our David Copperfields have two P's.
Probably, but the original by Edmund Wells also had two P's. It was after that that they ran into copyright difficulties. Sorry to trouble you.
Not at all.
John Cleese and Marty Feldman. The trouble with books is that every one of them has an author. And though some authors are perfectly delightful, others are a bit boring. The best source of unpleasant remarks about writers is other writers. Here's a typical generalization from Oscar Wilde.
In old days, books were written by men of letters and read by the public. Nowadays, books are written by the public and read by nobody.
Here's a nice little jibe from Austin O'Malley.
It is a mean thief for a successful author who plunders the dead.
This charge of plagiarism is one that's always being made. Here's a line from Nicholas Chamford.
Most contemporary books give the impression of having been manufactured in a day out of books read the day before.
An old anonymous epigram on the same theme.
Your comedy I've read, my friend, and like the half you pilfered best, be sure the piece you yet may mend. Take courage, man, and steal the rest.
Good idea. Here's a summing up of the motivation of the writer by Montesquieu.
An author is a fool who, not content with having bored those who have lived with him, insists on boring future generations.
As nowadays, the possibility for boring those who live with the writer are much greater. Publication is often followed by a television producer and camera crew making a documentary in the house or around the house. And the writer is given the opportunity to talk about his art and how he works.
At the moment, I'm working on a novel set entirely in the mind of an aging cinema usherette during a festival of Annenigle films. She's at the crossroads, really, desperately trying to come to terms with herself and the demands of her career. We explore her reverie, which is broken in on occasionally by the film or by the patrons wanting to be shown to their seats. We see how deeply, how tragically she's identified herself with the personality of Annenigle, and how tragic the inevitable outcome. It takes in, en passant, the eternal themes, love, death, birth, some of the less eternal ones, a love-hate relationship with the ice cream girl. If I can sum up, it's everything that Virginia Woolf failed to do, plus the best of Stan Barstow.
I asked him who influenced him the most.
Three people have influenced me more than anyone else. The first was Goethe. The second was Ortega y Gasset.
And the third?
I can't remember. She's very close to Bridget Brophy. Other times she just doesn't want to know.
So this is the writer in mid-career in the mid-60s. Lonely, dedicated, determined. What I'm above all primarily concerned with is the substance of life, the pith of reality. If I had to sum up my work, I suppose that's it, really. I'm taking the pith out of reality.
Alan Bennett with John Sargent. It's strange how incredibly uninteresting it is to hear an analysis of a writer's method. The interest lies in what he writes, not how he does it. Benjamin Disraeli.
The author who speaks about his own books is almost as bad as the mother who talks about her own children.
Yeah, the parallel may go deeper than that. I think it was Lord Mancroft who said that publication is for a man what childbirth is for a woman. Authors do have an obsessive interest in their own work. It may not always be shared by their listeners. The charge of being boring is one that's often levelled against them. Here are a couple more definitions by Ambrose Bierce. First, circumlocution.
A literary trick whereby the writer who has nothing to say breaks it gently to the reader.
And here's what sounds like an irrelevant one. Tsetse fly.
An African insect whose bite is commonly regarded as nature's most efficacious remedy for insomnia, though some patients prefer that of the American novelist.
But that sort of thing is not always an infallible cure, as Heinrich Heine observed.
I fell asleep reading a dull book, and I dreamt that I was reading on, so I awoke from sheer boredom.
It's difficult to know quite what the best approach is to reading a really dull book. But here's an idea from a wartime Evening Standard. Might come in useful.
Major Smalley will begin a book at the last line of the last page, reading through to the front, holding the book upside down. It takes him no longer than the normal way of reading, and he claims it gives printed matter freshness.
But is reading upside down what the author intended? Now, the author's intentions are often veiled in mystery, and their concern may be more with sales than with art. Over now to a writer of children's books.
Hello, boys and girls. I was so pleased when you asked me to come along and tell you about how I write my books for children. Well, of course, the answer is I don't. No, my books write themselves for me. I think we're all little ones at heart, aren't we, grown-ups? Yes, even the growly bear daddy's at the back. And I don't believe I have ever grown up. And I think perhaps that is my secret. That and the fact that kiddies come first with me. Well, as you know, children, I write lots and lots of books for you, and this is how I set about it. Well, first of all, I go upstairs to my hidey hole. Well, really, it's just a great big upstairs workroom, but I like to call it my hidey hole. And I pin a notice on the door, and it says, Gone to Make-Believe Land. That's just my way of saying, please don't come and bother me, because a book is writing itself for me, and we mustn't disturb it, must we? And then I sit down at my work table, and I've got a clean white sheet of paper into my typewriter, and I close my eyes. And what do I see? I see a rambling old house in Cornwall, and I hear seagulls. And I see children, one, two, three children, scrambling up the cliffs because they're very nearly late for tea. And their names are Jennifer Ann and Robin John. And there's a little one at the back, and he is called Midge, because he is the littlest one. Oh, yes, he has a proper name. It's Anthony Timothy Jeremy Michael, and he doesn't like porridge. But we won't tell anybody, will we? And I sit there, and I type, and I type, and as I do so, I learn all about Jennifer Ann's unruly mop of red curls and her way with hedgehogs, and about Robin John, who is more of a fish than a boy. Oh, you should see him dive from the top diving board. And all about their father, kindly, overworked, sunburnt, twinkling Dr. Merriweather. And then all of a sudden, it's dinner time, and I rub my eyes, and I find myself back in my hidey hole. And look, there's a great pile of typewritten pages on the table beside me. They must have written themselves while the story told itself to me. And so I go on till a book is made. And then I start another one. And this time it's a rambling old house in Yorkshire. And hark, I hear sheep bells. And look, I see children, three children, and their names are Sarah Mary, Jonathan Christopher, and there's a little one at the back, and he is called Tiddler, because he is the littlest one, etc., etc. It's always the same with me. No, I never revise, I never rewrite, and I never read what I have written. But you children do. Millions and millions of you children do, and that is my great joy. And it is my husband's great joy, too. He has given up his work to encourage me in mine. And together we have made hidey holes for each of our five children so they too may learn to let books write themselves for them. And my husband has his own hidey hole where he adds up.
Perfectly observed piece from the incomparable Joyce Grenfell. Authors always claim to be very sensitive to criticism, and considering some of the criticisms which are levelled at them, it's hardly surprising. Here's a good general attack by Charles Dickens.
There are books of which the backs and covers are by far the best parts.
A bit more demolition work from Rose Macaulay.
It was a book to kill time for those who liked it better dead.
Will Cuppy.
Sartor Resartus is simply unreadable. And for me, that always sort of spoils a book.
Mark Twain.
The Mormon Bible is chloroform in print. If Joseph Smith composed this book, the act was a miracle. Keeping awake while he did it was it, anyway.
And George DeWitt.
His books are selling like wildfire. Everybody's burning them.
Another way of attacking a writer is to draw attention to his lack of success. It may be true, as has been said, that everybody has a novel in them, but would all those novels have readers? Readers are what the novelist must have. A line from Stanley Walker.
He was an author whose works were so little known as to be almost confidential.
And another from Franklin Pierce Adams.
A first edition of his work is a rarity, but a second is rarer still.
Some literary circles, of course, that would be a compliment. There's a feeling that a novelist should be a misunderstood martyr to his art, and the popularity breeds contempt. A true novel is above such minor considerations as readers. After all, think of Mark Twain's definition of a classic.
A book which people praise but don't read.
There's a great cultural divide between art and rubbish in books, but a simple method of distinguishing them is the fact that rubbish is what people read. In the words of H.L. Mencken,
in the main, there are two sorts of books, those that no one reads and those that no one ought to read.
There's nothing wrong with reading rubbish, if that's what you enjoy. At times, we all need a good rubbishy book to settle down with. Here's a very shrewd observation from G.K. Chesterton.
There's a great deal of difference between the eager man who wants to read a book and the tired man who wants a book to read.
There are plenty available in the second category, as Charles Colton has observed.
Many books require no thought from those who read them, and for a very simple reason. They made no such demand upon those who wrote them.
And often those are the books that sell well. Many highly intelligent authors have realized this and adjusted their style accordingly. It makes good economic sense. Mark Twain.
My books are water. Those of great geniuses are wine. Everybody drinks water.
The best-selling author who mixes water to the public taste gains many advantages. There are all those possible film rights, translation rights, serial rights. Though some people don't like serials. Among them was Ambrose Bierce, who seems to have had a rather cynical attitude to most aspects of literature.
Serial, a literary work, usually a story that is not true, creeping through several issues of a newspaper or magazine. Frequently appended to each installment is a synopsis of preceding chapters for those who've not read them. But dire need is a synopsis of succeeding chapters for those who do not intend to read them. A synopsis of the entire work would be still better.
Some authors have difficulty in telling how well their works are selling. But there are other criteria of success. Here's a useful guide from Robert Benchley.
I've been told by hospital authorities that more copies of my works are left behind by departing patients than those of any other author.
One eternally popular form of fiction is the detective story, or whodunit, the more elegant title of crime novel. In the old days, these stories had fixed rules and plots you could set your watch by. They existed in a world which enabled J.B. Morton to come up with this definition.
Library, the room where the murders take place.
Now, alas, the old order is changing. Not, it seems, for the better. From a book review in the Church Times.
Turning to crime stories proper, we regret to note that murder seems to be losing all association with refinement.
It has been a literary shift amongst murderers. From the aristocracy, it's now gone down to the criminal classes. Not that it probably has a lot of effect on the average detective story addict, or on those who are less enthusiastic. Here's part of a letter sent to the Daily Mirror.
I spend hours at the local library reading detective stories, but I read only the first and last chapters of each. The only time I read one right through, I got so bored, I didn't care who committed a murder.
That's not at all the right attitude to crime novels. Some people take them more seriously.
I hate to think of this sort of book getting in the wrong hands. As soon as I've finished it, I'm going to recommend they ban it.
As good as that, is it? What's it about, then?
It's a murder mystery, you see.
Yes?
With loads of girls in it, and they've all fallen for the private eye, and they're all beautiful, and they're all rich, and he's got a big white American car,
go
you
on,
know.
Go on, then.
All right, yes? Go on, right. Oh, it is the sort of life you dream about. He's a good-looking, quick repartee, judo, you know, marvellous apartment, all the birds. Well, I'm finished with the saint after this. I'm a Johnny Oxford man now. This is marvellous. Here, 25 murders so far. The New York police don't know what's going on at all. The DA's been in to see the governor. Of course, it's political as well.
Oh, yes. Come on.
Anyway, Jocelyn Knockersbury.
Who?
As I say, Bon. Who? Jocelyn Knockersbury. A typist that you know has been done in and the plans stolen along with the seating arrangement at the peace conference. Now, hang on. Since which time, another 24 have been done in.
Well, all you know typists.
Hello. Another one's gone. Oh, what a nasty way to go. Somebody poured water all over an electric typewriter. Oh. Well, this is a mystery. Who's behind it all? That's what I've got to... Who's the murderer? Now, the bloke I suspect is in Salt Lake City.
Yes?
Yeah, it can't be him. Do you know, I've been wrong on every page so far. Every time I suspect somebody, they get killed. I can't wait to get to the end of this. It's going to be a very complicated ending, this one.
Yes, well, hurry up and finish it. It's getting late. Have a look at the last page.
You can't do that. It makes the whole thing pointless. Might just as well not read it. Like looking at the next card when you're playing snap. Do be quiet, will you, please? I've read the same sentence three times. Hello, hello. He's found something. It's all right. It's all right. Johnny knows who did it.
Yes?
He's found a ginger hair on her skirt.
No.
Yeah. He sold it. He's narrowed his eyes and a little smile flickered across his face. He always does that when he knows something.
Well, come on then. Who did it?
It'll be on the last page. He always keeps you in suspense till the last page, this bloke. Yes, I thought so. Yes, here we go. He's inviting everybody into his flat. He always does that. He lashes them up with drinks. Lights a cigarette.
Yes.
He explains who did it.
Yes.
The murderer rushes to the window, slips and falls, hits the pavement. And Johnny Oxford turns round to the guests, finishes his Manhattan, and says, New York is now a cleaner place to live in. The end. And you turn over a list of new books and an advert for skinny blokes.
Hey, if you know what's going to happen every time, why do you bother to read it?
Well, because I don't know who it is who's going to hit the pavement. Now, please keep quiet. Johnny's just starting his summing up prior to unmasking the murderer. He's all right. Oh. Yeah. Oh, so she was in on it.
Ooh.
No, it's not Jocelyn, the other lady. She said she'd never been to the Macambo Club, but she had a book of matches in her handbag.
No.
That's what put him onto it. That's clever. That's clever, you know. Of course, the trail of footprints in the snow, all made with a size 10 left-footed shoe. So it had to be somebody who could walk comfortably in two left shoes. He's got it here. That told him it was a small man who had put a big man's shoes on to lay the suspicion on somebody else. But he didn't realize in his hurry he'd put two left shoes on. But I never thought of that. I've been waiting for two one-legged twins to turn up.
So who did it then?
Well, he's coming to it. He's just coming. It's on the last page. I told you that. Here we are.
So, Inspector, you can see the only person who could have done all these murders is the man sitting over there. So saying, Johnny Oxford pointed his finger at. Men, are you skinny? Do you have sand? If you're skinny...
Wait a minute! That's not right. There's a page missing.
Tony Hancock and Sid James. Well, that just about ends Frank Muir Goes Into Books. Let's finish by hearing an anonymous author's epitaph.
I suffered so much from printer's errors that death for me can hold no terrors. I'll bet this stone has been misdated. I wish to God I'd been cremated.
Next, bye.
Bye.